case, we'll call him here, is David Michael Schmidt in Commonwealth of Virginia. Come on up, ma'am. Good afternoon.
May I please support Kristen Moline on behalf of Mr. Schmidt.
Okay. Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal, ma'am?
Maybe 2 minutes.
Sir. Yes, ma'am. You have it. Okay.
Sir, the first argument here before the court is the argument concerning the confrontation clause and the admission of the anomaly.
Well, ma'am, unless I'm mistaken, were you granted a petition on those two items?
Yes.
Well, then, let's talk about what you weren't granted on. You don't think there's sufficient evidence of this conviction?
Actually, Your Honor, I was here in April, and we argued that, and the court denied that. We're here on the merits for the two that were granted.
Okay, so the two that you're willing to focus on is the admission of the neuropathological report and the denial of the motion to dismiss on double jeopardy grounds.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And the trial court admitted the neurological report on the theory that it was covered by the statute and that it was part of the autopsy report. The trial court made the decision based on the Commonwealth's assertion that there was a statutory provision. The trial court pretty much ignored the constitutional argument that we made, as did the Commonwealth. But the argument is based actually on the Confrontation Clause and the fact that Bennett Amalu, the author of that report, did not appear.
As I understand, the Supreme Court's been dealing with this type of issue for the last 4 or 5 years, trying to make sense out of how to make this a reasonable approach to getting these reports in or not. And the Supreme Court has suggested that the way that the constitutional concern can be addressed is for there to be state statutory frameworks for the admissibility of these types of reports and this type of testimony. And it appears that the Commonwealth of Virginia is taking advantage of that. Why, under those circumstances, isn't the Constitution satisfied?
Well, they certainly do, for example, in a DUI case where they give notice pursuant to the statute as to the fact and give the defendant a right to object. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen here. That was not even an issue. The Commonwealth had originally subpoenaed Bennett Amalu, and there was we did not have conversations with him, and there was no indication that they were not calling him as a witness. They chose not to do it, and we found out at trial that he was not coming. So there was no statutory framework in place in this case.
You subpoenaed him, correct?
We did not subpoena him.
Okay, didn't the statute give you the ability to do that?
Your Honor, I didn't have any intention of wanting him here. To me, that report was not going to come in unless he was there. He was not my witness.
But if you're looking at it from a constitutional standpoint and there's a mechanism for you to be able to confront someone over something that he may or may not have filed correctly, and you fail to take advantage of the statutory framework for accomplishing that, aren't you essentially waiving any ability to complain about it later?
Well, Your Honor, I didn't know that you were going to ask me that question, but I will say to the court that I'm not aware that that statute that is applicable in the DUI framework applies in the medical examiner's framework.
But
I think it is in that section of the code, 18.266, and those that follow.
Well, did you not subpoena the doctor because you were confident his report was not going to be admissible?
No, he was not. He did not return our phone calls, Your Honor, and I do not make it a practice to subpoena people I haven't interviewed prior to putting them on the stand.
I understand. Thank
and
you.
And so he was not my witness. So, Your Honor, I did know that they were putting up the medical examiner, mm-hmm. and I knew that she was coming and that she would testify and admit her report. But this is an additional report without the witness. And these are things that were highly contested throughout the entire trial. There were, I know the Commonwealth in its argument indicates that he didn't make anything but findings. But even the report, on the very first page of the report, says it's a diagnosis. That's more than just documenting findings. That's interpreting. That's making an opinion. And then
don't people don't
back
as a don't people in science all the time rely on certain other reports and information and data provided by other scientists to reach their conclusions?
They do.
Okay. So what would be wrong with the doctor who actually testified relying on the data that had been created by another scientist?
Your Honor, she didn't have anything to do with the formulation of that. She was at the autopsy. Her office prepared slides and sent them off. It was prepared in Lodi, California. She was not present. She had. She said she looked at it when it came back. She didn't even indicate that she reviewed the slides herself. She did not even indicate that she looked at what he had done with a critical eye. She just got a report back, stapled it to her report, and sent it in. That's what she did. That doesn't satisfy the confrontation clause. There were many things in there that were highly disputed, and this was not an easy case for the jury. That jury was out Thursday afternoon, all day Friday, and from 9 to 2 on Monday. This was highly disputed, and words in that report, like acute, every doctor who testified gave a different definition of that. So if they're going to put that evidence on, that doctor needs to be there to be cross-examined as to what...
But getting back to the point that I believe Judge Haley and I both raised earlier, if that link is so necessary and you believe that it is the responsibility of the government to make that link, and the government chooses another methodology to accomplish their objective of providing the critical information necessary to support the prosecution, why doesn't the burden shift to you if you are concerned about the materiality of that particular report to question the person who is the proponent of the report or subpoena another person who prepared the report to come to court?
I would respond that the person who is offering the report has the duty to make it admissible.
Mm-hmm.
The burden doesn't shift to the defendant. You don't say to the defendant,
But if your objection is to the materiality of that report, you do have a responsibility.
My objection is to the fact that they put it in and didn't allow us the opportunity to cross-examine the person who did it. That's what the Confrontation Clause is about. We have a right to ask what he meant and what his findings were. He offered opinions and interpretations in that report, and that was before the court. Now, I don't know how much time I have.
You've got about seven minutes.
Or if you would like to discuss.
You have about 7 minutes. You can use it as you choose, counsel.
I did want to say a couple of things about the report. Certainly, in the brief for the government, there is an indication that the medical examiner did not rely on it. But her report does. Her report specifically, in her conclusion, she certainly does, and she certainly references back to the fact, see the neurological report of Dr. O'Malley. So that it certainly was before the jury because she was there and testified, and the autopsy report was there and available to them. So I believe that, and I would go back to the case law from the United States Supreme Court, which I do know that they offer the possibility to the state to provide a procedural avenue. To my knowledge, Virginia has not offered any procedural avenue with respect to an expert medical opinion. And I do believe that the section that we have so familiar with is in the DUI section of the code.
Okay.
And, Your Honor, so that is what I would say about that. The second argument has to do with the double jeopardy argument. The double jeopardy argument, I would rely on the statutory language itself. The case of Cotton has been my problem in this argument, but Cotton very generally says, references murder. It doesn't address murder under 18.233, which is the felony murder. And when you look at the language of 18.233, it says, in the prosecution of some felonious act. So you have to prove the felonious act. And if you have to prove the felonious act, you have to prove every element of the felonious act, or there is no felonious act.
But you would agree that the circumstances here, that the Commonwealth has a burden under one statute that it doesn't have under another statute, under the comparable statute.
I believe that it has a burden under 18.233 to prove all of the elements of the felony child abuse, plus an unintended death, an accidental death.
Okay.
So I believe that 18.233 adds the element of death to the felony child abuse statute. So that makes, because by proving that, requiring the Commonwealth to prove the felonious act, it includes every element of the child abuse statute, or every element of whatever felonious act they're attempting to prove. So therefore, what they're doing is, in bringing both of the charges, or convicting, punishing on both of the charges, is actually what it is. You can bring it with the idea that maybe there won't be a conviction on both. So it isn't the bringing of the two charges that is offensive to the Constitution. It is
your suggestion the government needs to make an election after they get a conviction on one or both. Get a conviction on both, they must make an election as to which one they're going forward on.
Correct. And that's, I think I cited the case of Andrews for that.
I remember Andrews, I was a trial judge.
Should I not say that then?
I was right. I got it right. Most part.
So, but that is the argument for that. And I believe that in the world of statutory construction, the very premise is that you follow the statute. We assume that the Constitution requires one punishment and one punishment only. Unless the General Assembly has indicated more than one is appropriate. Many of the cases cited by the appellee indicate that there were statutory language in there that were for enhancements for guns, enhancements for use of a firearm. Those are authenticated by the statute. That language comes in the statute. There's no statutory language in either of these. So the presumption is only one punishment for the act.
You're into your rebuttal time, counsel. I can save that for you, or you can watch your point.
I will save
it. All right. Thank you, ma'am. Busy day, Ms. Adelphia? Good recovery.
Well done.
Catherine Adelphia on behalf of the Commonwealth. The Sixth Amendment does not require that every person who's borne some role or forensic analysis actually come to court and testify. In this case, the Dr. Imalu offered essentially raw data upon which medical examiner D'Angelo based her conclusions with respect to the cause of the victim's death. She was there during the examination of the victim by Dr. Imalu, and she watched him prepare the slides. She was certainly able to testify with respect to the fact that she watched him prepare slides, and she was entitled to rely on that raw data, which the defendant, if I heard correctly, didn't really challenge, informing her conclusion that the victim died as a result of the slide.
Well, these were essentially the same arguments that were made in Aguilar, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And the Supreme Court came to the determination that the government's approach in Aguilar was an appropriate approach, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah. I would point out that and I think that Schmidt concedes this, it did not really seem like the medical examiner relied on Dr. Omalu's report at all. She didn't discuss it during the testimony. She did not rely on it in reaching the conclusion that he had blunt force trauma to his head. And the report itself did not include any conclusions with respect to what caused the victim's injury.
And you would agree, counsel, that there was nothing precluding the defendant from subpoenaing Dr. Mahayu, was there?
Yes, Your Honor. And I would note to this court that even if this report was testimonial, which is frankly an issue that the appellate courts in Virginia have dodged a number of times, any admission of the report is harmless error. And that is the determination that in the past the appellate courts have reached. They have decided that the admission of the report does not constitute harmless error. In this case, essentially, I heard Ms. Moline say that the medical examiner just stapled the report to the back of her autopsy report and essentially didn't rely on it. And I did not hear any response to the Commonwealth's suggestion on brief that any objection to the information, the raw data included in the report, was waived. The defendant's own witnesses testified essentially to the exact same raw data that was included in Omalu's report. They just reached a different conclusion as to what it meant, what that raw data meant, what the subdural membrane hemorrhages meant, what the injuries to the eye meant. They reached the conclusion that these were somehow effects of injuries that were incurred earlier during the child's birth. The Commonwealth's experts testified differently, that these were somehow injuries caused by trauma unrelated to the child's birth. So I did not hear any response to the Commonwealth's suggestion that the defendant has waived any objection to the admission of the raw data included.
So it's almost in the nature of approbate and reprobate. They don't want you to be able to use it, but yet they could use it.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, Isaac versus Commonwealth, which I said it on brief, has held that when the same information comes in at trial through other sources, the defendant's sources, the defendant waives any objection to the admission of that same information by the Commonwealth's witnesses. And finally, as I argued on brief, I would suggest that any admission of this report by Dr. Omalu was, in fact, harmless. It did not seem like the medical examiner relied on it. There's no evidence that she relied on it, even if it was tabled to the back of her report. She, in reaching her conclusion that RHS died as a result of blunt head trauma, she only discussed the things that she observed during the autopsy. I'd also suggest that the information found by Dr. Omalu was also observed by Drs. Hoda and Foster with respect to the injuries to the brain and the injuries to the victim's eyes. And so for those reasons, because Dr. Omalu's report was essentially cumulative, and in fact the defendant's experts, Drs. Uzinski, Scheller, and Arden, made similar observations with respect to the victim's brains and eyes, any error in the admission of the report was harmless and should not constitute reversible error. And to briefly address
double jeopardy.
The double jeopardy argument, as Ms. Moline suggested during her argument, Cotton is a problem for her. Cotton is dispositive. In Cotton, this court held that felony murder doctrine should not be eviscerated, that an individual can be convicted for and sentenced for both felony murder and felony child abuse. They do have different elements. The felony murder doctrine does not require that the victim have in some sort of special relationship with the defendant, and for those reasons, it was appropriate to sentence the defendant for both felony murder and felony child abuse.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Got a little over 2 minutes, ma'am.
And I'll try to be back fast.
All right.
I don't believe that I would disagree that the medical examiner said that she was pregnant when Dr. O'Malley made the slides. I don't believe Dr. O'Malley made the slides. The quote is 427 of the appendix. Again, the dissection was completed. Representative sections were taken from different areas of the brain and other tissues that were there. The material was processed within our facilities, and the stained slides sent to
us. Ms. Adelfio suggested waiver and or approbate and reprobate. In other words, what she's suggesting is that all that Dr. Malyu prepared was raw data that was used, arguably, both by the government and used by your client. Why is she incorrect in that
statement? She's incorrect because the report, if it's read correctly, does a lot more than that. And it has a lot of opinion in it. It has a lot of interpretation in it. And it uses words that were challenged throughout the trial.
Well, it's got a lot of opinion, but does it arrive to the point of being opinion that is testimonial in nature?
Yes. Yes, it does, sir. And I will just to comment on the notion that everyone looked at the same information, but our expert witnesses, for example, Dr. Arden, I assume the forensic doctor is the one that she's speaking to, but he got duplicate slides. He did his own analysis. He didn't go back and look at Dr. O'Malley's analysis. We went to the extra effort of getting him the direct slides from the medical examiner's office, and he did his own analysis. That's what he was testifying to, not what Dr. O'Malley found, and not to Dr. O'Malley's findings,
But you would agree that most times when you're dealing with a case such as this, where the evidence is circumstantial in nature, that it becomes a battle of the experts.
It's not unusual.
All right. And in a battle of the experts, aren't we typically left with the responsibility as an appellate court to defer to the factual determinations and the credibility determinations of the people testifying?
I would say you could not defer to the witness that did not present himself for cross-examination.
Okay.
And, sir, I would respond to the waiver. The Isaac case is about putting the BAC in. It's about objecting to the government putting the BAC in and then putting in a BAC yourself. That's a lot different than saying, well, your expert did an analysis, and so their analysis can come in without the witness. That's putting in, that would be if I put Dr. O'Malley's analysis in, I couldn't complain about it. But I didn't. I put Dr. Arden's analysis in. So they're apples and oranges. It's like one of the cases that is cited in the brief has to do with an agreement, objecting to putting an agreement in, but then putting in a deposition with the agreement attached to it. Well, of course you can't then come to the appellate court and complain when it was your exhibit.
Well, since your time's expired and you've mentioned apples and oranges, which makes everybody think about lunchtime, we'll go ahead and end on that note, okay?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.